The opening prayer for today is from Psalm 98, verses 5 through 9. Sing to the Eternal with the harp and the sound of a psalm, with trumpets and the sound of a horn. Shout joyfully before the Eternal, the King. Let the sea roar in all its fullness, the world and those who dwell in it. Let the rivers clap their hands. Let the hills be joyful together before the Eternal. For he is coming to judge the earth. With righteousness he shall judge the world and the peoples with equity. Amen. Good afternoon. Shabbat Shalom. I think the last time I spoke to you, it was storming out here. Or at least recently it has been, but today is calm, a calm day. And here we are in Central Florida. And wherever you are, I hope that the day is going well for you. Many of you are listening live, I hope, on the Sabbath day, the fifth day of the first month of the ecclesiastical year, the sacred year. We're now in Aviv, the spring. We're in the month of Nisan. Next Sabbath, I hope to be in Northern California. Speaking from there, I hope to have the service, of course, as usual, generating from there. I suppose we'll probably need to do it at noon, San Francisco, you know, California time, so it can be 3 o'clock here. That's when we've been doing it. So I guess so that people aren't disrupted, we'll do it at noon there. And so you can be hearing it at 3 o'clock here live or at noon on the West Coast. If we do change that, then we'll try to inform everybody as quickly as we can electronically if there's some change in that regard. Some of the West Coast people may be up there for that service on the Sabbath. Others may come later on. That Sunday night will be the New Testament Passover. It's called by various terms. You know, it's called the Lord's Supper by some. But in any case, we plan to be doing it on Sunday night in Concord, California. And then on Monday night, the festival begins with Leil Shimurim, which we have traditionally translated as night to be much observed. And then the next morning, Tuesday, we'll have a holy day service. I guess we'll do it in the morning, but not really early, but in the morning on the first day of unleavened bread. So we'll announce that on the Sabbath coming up, so you'll know when. If you want to listen live on Tuesday during the first day of unleavened bread, you'll know when to listen. We'll make that announcement on Sabbath. We'll also make it again at the New Testament Passover as well. We'll make that announcement on Sunday night as well. Not tomorrow night, but a week from Sunday night. There's a radio host that's very well known in America, and he likes to say that he carries out his responsibilities flawlessly. Well, I wish I could say the same for my sermons, but I try to be as flawless as possible. Last week I made some announcements, and I wanted to turn to Deuteronomy 12, and I finally did say Deuteronomy 12, but a couple of times I think I said Exodus 12. I kind of had Exodus 12 on the brain because of the coming Passover season, but I did turn to Deuteronomy 12 and finally did say so. So I guess if you were patient, you finally heard the right verse. But I'll try to be flawless, but it cannot be guaranteed in my case. Sometimes we get into some very profound issues here as we talk about the Bible. For example, why didn't Noah swat those two mosquitoes when he had the chance? But anyway, I do want to talk about Noah today, though. But I want to talk about the biblical Noah. I'm calling this talk Some Comments on the Biblical Noah. The reason I'm saying it that way, Some Comments on the Biblical Noah, is because I don't want people to think, you know, if they're surfing around, that this is a movie review. It isn't. I've not seen that movie and don't plan to. And that doesn't mean you should or shouldn't. There may be times as a pastor, as a minister, when I may want to recommend a movie, and there may be times as a minister when I want to discourage seeing a particular movie. But in this case, I neither, you know, recommend or discourage. You know, what you want to do with your, you know, in this particular case is up to you, but I have not seen it. I've heard a lot about it, but I haven't seen it. But I want today to talk about the biblical Noah, because I think people are thinking about Noah, because some have seen the movie or they've heard about the movie. And so Noah has come up in current conversation. Not only that, but this is the time of the year when we should be reading material in Genesis. This is a time of new beginnings. This is a time of the spring. This is the beginning of the ecclesiastical year. The holy day cycle is beginning. So it's a time to go into Genesis and the first book of Psalms and the Song of Solomon, Shir HaShirim, Canticles, the Song of Songs. It's a time to go into the the first book of the Psalms, which I, if I haven't said it, I should say the first book of the Psalms, 1 through 41. That first book has a lot to say about Jesus' human ministry. Those first 41 Psalms, the first two are a kind of overview of God's plan, and then we get into a lot of different prophecies about Jesus' ministry that you can read about, including the 22nd, which he quoted as he was dying. So it's a time of year to focus, not to, of course, read any, you know, read any part of the Bible. That I can recommend. I don't talk much about movies, but I do talk a lot about the Bible. So any part of the Bible you want to read, but especially this time of year, we tend to get into the themes of new beginnings. And that's really what we're talking about in the case of Noah. Yeah, Noah was a person who had the opportunity for a new beginning. Adam begins the human race, you know, human beings as we understand the term. Humankind begins with Adam and Eve, but a new beginning it begins with Noah. And of course, a great new beginning comes with the ministry of Jesus Christ, the second Adam. A great new beginning. And there'll be yet another new beginning when he returns. A new beginning of another sort. When I was a child, I shouldn't say quite that, when I was a young man, there was a very popular comedic routine about Noah. Bill Cosby, whose name is still known, he's still famous, but when I was, you know, way back in the 60s, Bill Cosby had a famous routine about Noah that maybe a lot of you have heard, and if you have not, you could probably find it. I'm sure, I imagine it's out there in the electronic universe, in cyberspace, whatever we call it. This routine he did about Noah was very famous. And then, if you're a baby boomer, and even if you're not, you probably have heard of the very famous Ed Sullivan Show, a unique program, which I don't think there's really anything like it now in a major way, on American TV, in a major significant way. The Ed Sullivan Show, anyway, there was a time when it was quite an institution in the United States. And at that time, John Huston was directing a movie called The Bible in the Beginning, came out in the 1960s, and there was a very important segment about Noah. And he was gathering animals. He had kind of like a zoo. I think he filmed the movie in Italy, so he had all these animals. He had a menagerie there in Italy, and so Ed Sullivan was there with him, I think, on scene, or somebody was. It was on the Ed Sullivan Show anyway, and they went around. And John Huston talked about being with the animals, and it was a plug for the movie. And later on, of course, the movie came out. I didn't go to see it, but I saw it years later on TV. Probably I've seen it several times on TV, bits and pieces of it, and maybe the whole thing. A lot of you are aware of it. So there was a presentation of Noah then that a lot of people no doubt were influenced by. Their concept of Noah may very well be, you know, from that particular film. There was also a TV program. There was a miniseries on the Bible, and I remember they did a program on Noah there. And there have been some really weird, you know, versions of that story. There was one famous one that had a very, you know, very, you know, man whom I admire a lot, John Voight, but it was a very strange, I didn't see it, but I heard about it. I think I saw previews for it, but it was very strange. It really distorted the story. And I don't mean it isn't any, you know, condemnation, but it was just a rather strange rendition of the story. Again, it was on TV, as some kind of TV special or whatever. So the story has been told and retold over the centuries. In fact, I don't know if Linda is able to do this. If you want to bring the ark here that we have, you can do it. If you can't do it, fine. But if you're able to bring the ark, just to show you the influence of the ark on pop culture. But the story of Noah has had a big influence on pop culture. And as I said, recently there's been this movie that's made a lot of money, I guess. I'm not sure if it's made back what they spent on it. But again, you know, Noah is a popular figure in pop culture in many ways. I was going to say, if you come to my house and you want a cup of tea... Okay, here we go. If you come to my house and you want a cup of tea, yeah, here's a version of the ark, although, isn't it, you know, that there's tea bags inside. But, I mean, that shows you the influence of the ark on pop culture, that people would think to make a beautiful ark, you know, for containing whatever. Pardon me?
It's a cookie jar.
Oh, it's actually a cookie jar. All right. So it has had, as I said, an influence on pop culture, but it's very important as a biblical account. And, you know, the Bible gives us revelation. Historians can uncover facts. Archaeologists can uncover facts. Scientists, of course, can uncover principles of how the universe operates. But there's some information. In order to piece it together, we need the biblical revelation. And the Bible reveals that a worldwide flood wiped out humanity at a certain point in history, roughly 2328 BC, about 4,500 years ago. And actually, archaeology demonstrates this. If you were to read an account of ancient Mesopotamia, ancient Egypt, you find the disruption about that time. And I think if you go back and review, you'll find the Old Kingdom ends, and then you have the Middle Kingdom. And you have a disruption in human history about that time. Now, obviously, historians are not going to put pieces all together and say, "Oh, this is evidence for a catastrophic flood in the Middle East, in all the Middle East." They're not going to want to go there. But you can find that evidence if you're looking for it. And as I said, that's where revelation comes in. You know, in areas where we wouldn't know without God telling us, He tells us. And He lets us, and He informs us, and He lets us know. And there's some very important spiritual lessons I just got a message here about my grandson Gideon. A friend of ours in Orlando did a baby shower for Gideon, and the theme was Noah. How they did that, I don't know. I wasn't there, so I guess it was a woman's activity. Or for whatever reason, maybe I was teaching at the time. But this baby shower for Gideon with the theme was Noah. So, you know, as I said, Noah is a part of popular culture. But it actually is a historical event. And in fact, the various flood accounts in the ancient world ought to show us that there was indeed an event. I think most historians would concede that. They would concede that there's all these different flood accounts which would seem to point to an actual event. They would, of course, not want to believe it was the kind of event the Bible talks about, a worldwide event. But I don't see how they could deny that something, a major flood occurred when you have all of these accounts in various mythologies of the ancient world about it. But there are a lot of lessons to be learned from the account of Noah, the biblical Noah, the actual Noah, the historical Noah. And I want to, you know, go into some of it to some degree today. So that's why I'm calling this talk Some Comments on the Biblical Noah. First of all, when we talk about Noah, we're talking about a person who had a very important end-time ministry, you could say. He was dealing with a world corrupted, a world of sin that had to be, in effect, washed away, wiped out, and cleansed, and then remade, in a sense, in a more positive way. And that's what's going on this time of year. That's what we're doing with ourselves. We're getting rid of the leaven. And so spiritually speaking, we're getting rid of the spiritual leaven. We're renewing our commitment to what is right. You know, so in effect, we're washing away the old and emerging with the new. which is the symbolism of baptism, and that's what the flood symbolized, a sort of baptism, a recommitment of the world to God's plan. And so the account of Noah is certainly very thematic of this time of the year, spiritually speaking. I want to go to Hebrews 11, which is the faith chapter, the hall of fame of faith. And in Hebrews 11 and verse 7, it says, "By faith Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen." Isn't that true of us? You know, we know from Bible prophecy, we understand that Christ came, and we understand that he promised to come again. That's clear in the Bible, but we believe it. There are some who, they know it's there, but they don't take it as seriously, or they take it maybe in some poetic sense, metaphoric sense, but not in the literal sense of a second coming. We are among those who literally believe in a second coming, because we believe in those messianic prophecies of the Old Testament, which Jesus did not fulfill in his first coming, and is not yet fulfilled. So there is going to come a second coming of Jesus Christ. The messianic era to which the Jews were looking forward when he came the first time. And yet it is not here, but we believe it on faith, as Noah. He didn't see the flood then. He had to wait a while. He had something, a lot to do in the meantime. But it says, "By faith, Noah being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world, because he did what God said and others were not." You know, he in effect showed that he was righteous in obeying God and others were not. "He condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith." So by carrying out God's command, he saved himself and his family, and of course the human race, because we all come from Noah. If you look at you know, he's mentioned in Luke 3 in the genealogy there. He's mentioned in 1 Chronicles and, of course, in Genesis 10. You know, he's in these genealogies because the human race comes from Noah and his wife. And then, of course, they had the three sons who had three wives, you know, each a wife to each son. And then the children from there repopulated the earth after the flood. In 1 Peter, the second chapter, the example is talked about again in 1 Peter 2 and verse 5. It is in 1 Peter 2, 5, but it's in 1 Peter. I'm looking for 1 Peter's reference to Noah. So, we're looking for that, let's go on to 2 Peter 3 and verse 20, and we'll go back to 1 Peter. 2 Peter 2, 5. That's the mistake I made. All right. 2 Peter 2 and verse 5. So as I said, I don't do things flawlessly, but I did correct myself quickly anyway. I'll say that for it. 2 Peter 2 and verse 5. We're going into the middle of a thought here. And I'll say a little bit more about this later, but I don't want to get off too much on this. But the fact is that there is a spirit world. The fact is that God did create angels, and that we understand that a third of them rebelled under an angel who had the title of Halel ben Shachar, we normally call Lucifer, who became Satan, HaSatan, the adversary, or Diablos, the slanderer, the devil. And so they rebelled, and they were put in a sense in a place of Tartaru, of restraint, for the time being, you know, they're on Earth, but they are, unfortunately, they have a great deal of influence on Earth. They are influencing people in a negative way, but of course their influence is temporary. It's not going to be forever. Saying that, let's go to verse 4 of 2 Peter 2. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down, you know, to, in this case, I believe it's Tartarus. It says hell here, but the marginal say Tartarus, which is in effect a place of restraint, and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. So these angels were punished in a sense, but the full judgment will come later. In verse 5, and did not spare the ancient world. And so when human beings sinned, it got to the point where it was so bad that the world was wiped out. And only 8 people survived. Now that shows how bad it got. And that was in 1656 years. So it was just so sad to think that in 1656 years, things got to be in such a dire state that God had to, in effect, wipe out humanity and start over. But that's what happened. Now that is a lesson for us that after a while, eventually, you know, things will come to a head. Now this time around, it's not going to get as bad as everybody but 8 people. But there is coming a climax again in a judgment period, just as happened then. That is a lesson for us. The fact that God intervened the way he did then is a lesson for us. Now, he promised he's not going to bring a flood again. We know that's not going to happen. But there will come an apocalyptic time, as we understand. And as it says here, as a forerunner, in verse 5, it did not spare the ancient world, but save Noah. You know, one of 8 people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly. So God does ultimately judge wickedness. He will not put up with it forever. The world right now is getting into a state, unfortunately, where there's profound wickedness going on in a major way. We'll have to see at what point things begin to descend into chaos, because they're beginning to seemingly go in that direction. I'm quite concerned about just the nature of civilization in the world at this point, because it seems that we're in many ways heading for very chaotic times. But of course, we knew that. We were warned about that in the Bible, so we understand such times are coming. So obviously we need to be closer to God and closer to each other as the years go by, as we deal with a more and more chaotic situation. Now, as I said, you know, what happened to Noah was a type of baptism. He was in an ark where he had water all around him, you know, water pouring on him and clouds and water under him. And he was just surrounded by water. And then he came out onto dry land. You know, he emerged out of the ark. And so it was a kind of baptism experience. And it is a type of baptism, which is at this time of year something we think about. You know, when we participate in the foot washing service, in effect, it's a rebaptism in a sense. You know, somebody is washing our feet, somebody who shares our commitment to this way of life, not necessarily a baptized person, but somebody who in the community in any case. So in that sense, we're being washed, you know, by a brother or sister, in the community. And we're in effect recommitting ourselves to walk this way. We're washing our feet. We don't have to go through the baptism again. We've gone through it once, but the foot washing is a kind of each year, a kind of rebaptism. And for those who are not baptized members, it's a kind of foreshadowing of what they will yet be called upon to do someday. I believe a non-baptized person could participate in the foot washing. I don't believe you have to be baptized to participate in that aspect of the New Testament Passover service. So for those who are not baptized, it's a foreshadowing of the need for baptism at some point in their lives as they are mature enough to deal with that issue. I remember as a young man in 1968 attending Pentecost services when one of the ministers got up and said, some of you are not making sufficient progress because you haven't been baptized. And I thought, hey, yeah. You know, I hadn't been attending that long, but it hit me that that's something to think about. So I began counseling for baptism, and I was baptized on the June 23rd of 1968. So it was after Pentecost of 68 that I was baptized. in Emerson, New Jersey. If any of you are listening in that area, I was baptized in Emerson, New Jersey. Anyway, I'd like to go to 1 Peter 3. 1 Peter 3. And again, we see these spirit beings talked about, these demonic spirits. They're in a state of restraint. And evidently, before the flood, Jesus preached to them and in effect, restricted them so they could not affect life on the ark. I mean, if you're going to have all those animals there, you've got to have special divine protection, because that's not the way animals normally behave. How do you have all these animals on the ark? Excuse me. I think that's one of the things that probably Bill Cosby satirized. You know, how do you have all these animals on the ark, and how do you deal with those sorts of issues? So there was obviously a divine protection, a presence of God in that situation, unique in many ways. And that would be what Jesus would have done in advance of the flood. He would have, in effect, warned, you know, these demonic spirits and restrained them. So I'm here in verse 18 of 1 Peter 3. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive by the Spirit, by whom also he went and preached to the spirits in prison, who formerly were disobedient, when once the divine long-suffering waited in the days of Noah, you know, 1656 years, and finally he did have to act, in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is 8 souls, were saved through water. And so here's what Peter says about it. It was an antitype. What is the type? What is the fulfillment? Let's put it another way. It was the type. All right? It was the type. What is the antitype for the fulfillment? Is baptism. You know, so baptism is the antitype. All right? Follow that. There's a type and there's an antitype. The type is the foreshadowing, you know, the symbol. And then the antitype is what is the fulfillment, you know, what it really means in the spiritual sense. Are we okay on that? Type, antitype. So the type was the flood and Noah being spared through water. You know, the people around him die, he lives. Very likely the people around him might have taken his life had there not been a flood. He probably was in danger, as Enoch was. You know, Enoch and Noah are, in a sense, the two witnesses of the pre-flood world, Enoch and Noah. Enoch's name has to do with training or dedication, instruction. And Noah's name has to do with rest, comfort. He's a type, again, speaking of type, antitype, he's a type of Jesus Christ. Because, of course, he brings comfort to the world. He brings the new beginning that Jesus ultimately brings, the greatest new beginning. But Noah, or Noach, he's really in Hebrew Noach, Nun Chet. You should put like a dot under the H, you know. It's Noach. It means comfort or rest. So we had Enoch, and we had Hanoch, Enoch, and we had Noach. And Enoch was saved, you know, providentially. He would have evidently been killed, but God took him away, where he was saved. And in Noah's case, he was put in an ark with his family. Verse 21. There is also an antitype which now saves us. Baptism. Okay, so baptism is the antitype. The great flood pictures baptism. I remember when I was in Israel back in 1969, I was in the house of a Jew from Iran. There were quite a few of us visiting him, students at the time. And guess what was on TV? Walt Disney, the Walt Disney program there in around Jerusalem. Walt Disney. And guess what they were showing? They were showing animated dinosaurs. And it wasn't a cartoon. It was an educational presentation about the world of the dinosaurs. So this was an Orthodox Iranian Jew. He sat in his home with a kippah, with a skull cap, a yarmulke. And he said to me in Hebrew, you know, something like, Zeh haya lifnei hamabul, as he looked at the animated Tyrannosaurus Rex there. He Zeh haya lifnei hamabul. This was before the deluge, you know, before the flood of Noah. Anyway, verse 21. There is also an antitype which now saves us, baptism, not the removal of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience. So we're not really concerned about washing ourselves in the physical sense. That's not what baptism is. It's a symbol of a spiritual cleansing. But the answer of a good conscience toward God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So when we come up out of baptism, it's a type of the resurrection. Who has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers having been subject to him. So you see, the account of Noah is a very important account, and it is a historical account. It is not myth, it is history. Now I believe there are maybe ways you can interpret it that may vary, and I think we need to be tolerant of different views on that subject. I would personally dare say that the human race had probably expanded to some degree in 1656 years, but may not have gone to, say, Australia, for example. And it may be that Australia was not part of the matter at the time, which is maybe why you have all these exotic animals over there. If you go to the book of Mark, and I want to go to Mark 1 and verse 4. I was talking about baptism, so let's mention the baptizer. Let's mention Yohanan, you know, John the Baptizer, John the Baptist. And in Mark 1 and verse 4, it says, John came baptizing in the wilderness and preaching a baptism of repentance for the remission of sins. Then all, verse 5, the land of Judea and those from Jerusalem went out to him and were all baptized by him in the Jordan River, confessing their sins. I don't think the word all here is intended to mean every last man, woman, and child in the area. But it's a literary statement, you know, meaning so many went, and perhaps each area was represented, each village, each family. But if you read it, you wouldn't assume from reading it that it was everybody there. So the all also in Genesis, maybe referring to those areas where there were people, where there was sin. And if there was no people, if there were no people in those areas, there was no sin, and there wouldn't be any reason to flood it out necessarily. It seems the flood came where there was sin. You know, this is, you know, a way of talking about it. We also have to consider that when you get to the high mountains, there you would have snow-capped mountains, and that would, you know, be included in waters covering the earth, because that is frozen water covering those mountains. So as you get really high, you get into snow-capped mountains there. That would also partly explain the waters covering up to the mountains there. That's just some ideas, you know, to talk about, to think about. I'd like to go to the book of Mark. And again, as I said, Jesus talked about events in Genesis as historical events because they are. In fact, I hadn't planned to turn there, but I'm going to go to Psalm 119 and verse 60. It is in the section beginning with the letter Resh. Let me see, Reshin Tav. So Resh is the 19th letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So let's go to the Resh section, which is Psalm 119 and verse... Did I say 60? I should have said 160. I'm sorry if I said 60. 160. Psalm 119, 160. It says in the Hebrew, Rosh Devaracha. Remember, all of these verses in Psalm 8 begin with Resh. In fact, in your Bibles, you probably have the word Resh there, which is the 19th letter of the Hebrew alphabet. You may even have a Resh printed there. But the word Resh is if you look at the letter Resh, maybe it looks like the beginning of a profile, like somebody is doing a profile of the back of your head. Rosh means head in Hebrew, Rosh. Some of you have heard of Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year or new year. Anyway, in Psalm 160, it says, Rosh Devaracha Emet, the beginning of your word is true. Because that's where you have the controversy, Genesis. There's a lot of things in Genesis that are very controversial. We have to understand what they mean, you know, but they are true. But here it says the entirety of your word is truth. Okay, that's the way they translate it. There are various ways to translate it. You can check different translations. The Hebrew word is Rosh. And I would translate it, your word is true from the beginning. Rosh Devaracha Emet. The entirety of your word is true. And every one of your righteous judgments endures forever. Now, as I didn't say, but will say now, if you want to take the first 11 chapters of Genesis as not as literal as what begins in the 12th chapter, I wouldn't condemn you for that. I personally do. But I wouldn't condemn you if you felt that perhaps the first 11 chapters are somehow, because of the way they're written, the style and the material there, if you want to somehow understand them differently. Obviously, the spiritual truths are valid and must be observed without question. Any laws there, any commandments must be observed. But if for some reason some of you want to be more imaginative in how you understand the literalness of those chapters, I would not condemn you for that. But I personally do believe literally in the historicity, literally, of those 11 chapters, including the account of Noah. And that does seem to be the approach taken by Jesus Christ in the Gospels. I would like to go to Matthew 24 and verse 36 in that regard. You know, one of the lessons we can learn from the time of Noah is that he had a ministry where he had an end time message to give. He had a warning to give that God would indeed judge the wickedness of that time. And that, you know, things were not going to go on forever, but there would come a halt to it. You know, God would pull the plug on it in a sense. Or in this case, you know, wash it out, wash it away and pull the plug on it. And not that it's anything humorous. It's a very, very horrific thing that happened, but it was needed. But again, there's going to come horrific times in the future that are needed. So on faith, we preach this message. On faith, we understand that. On faith, we prepare for it as best we can. We don't know when it's coming, but we have that faith that Noah had. But at the same time, we realize the world will go on generally as is until things begin to really come to a head. That is, there may be ups and downs, there may be problems, but people will somehow muddle through, and they'll continue to try to survive, try to work and provide for themselves and their families, and there'll be occasions, there'll be weddings and the funerals and so on, you know, until such time as the cataclysm occurs. But just as in Noah's day, people kept right on living until it began to rain very powerfully and, you know, and they realized that they were in very, very big trouble. But they kept on living normally until that time and evidently ignored Noah, ignored his warnings. Only his family were saved. Evidently the others ignored his warning. Methuselah died in the year of the flood. Now he didn't necessarily die as a sinner. He happened to die the year of the flood. The Jews believed that God delayed the flood until after his death. They, you know, there's a traditional week-long mourning period among Jews. And if you notice in the Bible, I may read it later, you know, one more week went by before God brought the flood. Traditionally, the Jews believed that was a mourning period for Methuselah. But in Matthew 24 and verse 36, he says, but of that day and hour, talking about his second coming. But Jesus is talking about his second coming. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For in the days before the flood they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be. So he says, when I come a second time, life will go on pretty much as normal until I come. There'll be a lot of very difficult events, cataclysmic events, but people will do as best they can to try to, you know, keep on going, and you won't necessarily know this is the end until, in fact, you know, it is. Things begin to happen that begin to fulfill these prophecies in the Bible. You know, people sometimes talk to me and they say, when is the end coming? And I tell them the signs to look for are in the Bible. A lot of events may happen in the world that seem to, you know, to indicate it, but it's not a matter of seem. It's a matter we know of specific things that are going to happen that the Bible talks about. And until those times, we're not at the end. I mean, think of the 14th century, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. Think of the 14th century when so many people in Europe were dying in mass. When what percentage of the whole European population? A third or whatever it was? A huge percentage of the entire European population died. And how long ago was that? You know, that was 700 years ago, nearly. You know, life went on after that. That was not the end time. The people there probably thought it was, but it was not. So, although a lot of things are going to happen, Jesus told us. Yeah, things are going to happen, he told us, but There are certain specific things he prophesied to look for. So we need to understand those events, and particularly in Revelation. And when those begin to happen, then we will know that the end is near. So life will go on as in the days of Noah until the very dramatic, very quick conclusion. So let's go to, there's so many other things I wanted to talk to say about Noah, but if I don't get to the story itself, I won't even talk about him much. So let me just say that Noah is mentioned in Ezekiel, Noah is mentioned in Isaiah. Noah is a very important person in the Bible. And in Noah, this, in not in Noah 6, but in Genesis 6, let's go to Genesis 4 first, because I want to talk about something I talked about last week. Genesis 4 and verse 26. And as for Seth, to him also a son was born, and he named him Enosh, or Enos. Then men began to call on the name of the Eternal. So it would seem that at that time, speaking of time, I'm not going to have a lot of time to talk about Noah, but it's okay. I got you into the thinking about Noah, and maybe some of you will now study the account from that perspective that I've given you. Maybe I hope it will help you if you do read the account to give you some deeper insights into it. And if you want to share some of them with me on email, or God willing, maybe up in Concord in a few days, share some of your insights on Noah with me when we meet up in Concord. But anyway, we see here in Genesis 4:26 a work of God taking greater form, a church of God becoming active. And of course, Enoch continues that ministry. And the reason I bring it up is because of something that it says in Deuteronomy 7, which I'm going to turn to. It's hard to believe that I'm still turning to Deuteronomy 7 when I was going to talk about Noah, but I need to do this as background. I should probably do this as a 4 or 5 part series, right? Anyway, Deuteronomy 7, he says in verse 3, you know, regarding these Canaanites, they were a very debauched people. They did terrible things. The Canaanites really did very terrible things to each other and to others. And God says, you don't marry with those people. You don't form covenants with those people. Deuteronomy 7:3. Nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their son, their daughter for your son. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Eternal will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. You're not going to marry these people because they are just so debauched, so degenerate, and you don't want to get, you know, you don't want to be influenced by them. Well, unfortunately, if we go back now to Genesis 6, that did happen to God's people in the time before the flood. People who were part of the community of the godly decided, you know, that there were some really, you know, hot chicks in the other camp, you know, and deluded away, seduced away from their commitment to God's way. And after a while, it got to the point where God's church was virtually gone, and we just had Noah and his family. I'm going to read about that now. Genesis 6. Now it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God, B'nai HaElohim, you know, the community of faith, B'nai HaElohim, the sons of God saw the daughters of men, just, you know, anybody's daughter, just you people out there that hadn't made a commitment to God, and they were beautiful. Well, yeah, physically they might have been attractive, but there's more to life than that. And they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And this was the beginning of the downfall of, you know, of God's work at that time, mixing with others to the point of assimilation. Now, there's another meaning to this verse that could be there, and maybe both are true. Another possible meaning to this verse is it has to do with the sons of the mighty, the judges, the gods, the heroes of that time. Began to throw their weight around, and in effect took for themselves wives, and so they began to gather harems. The powerful began to take whom they chose for wives. The way kings have done over the years, the way Xerxes did. I read about Ahasuerus not long ago at the Purim season. I read about Ahasuerus and how he, in his power, could just gather up large numbers of beautiful women, virgins, and take them for his harem. And okay, if I like them, they can come back to me. Otherwise, they'll live well in the palace and the harem. And maybe I'll get around to them again. Maybe I won't. You know, this kind of attitude. What a civilization. So that could also be what's meant here, that the powerful gather to themselves women, and, you know, because they had the power to do so, the authority to do so, and perhaps they became polygamous. There is a case in Genesis of Lamech who took two wives. That's the first documented case of bigamy, is in the fourth chapter of Genesis with Lamech. But now you probably have more than just bigamy. You probably have polygamy taking place. So that's another way to perhaps understand the verse. So you can understand in verse 3 then that God, in either case, in both cases, is going to be upset with the way things are going. And the Eternal said, "My Spirit." So you here again you have God's Spirit in Genesis. And the Eternal said, "My Spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he indeed is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. So he gave human beings 120 more years, and they didn't, 3 times 40, right? 40 being a period of trial, and so 3 times that, you know, the absolute judgment occurs once, twice, 3 times, right? 3 strikes and you're out. So 3 times 40, 120. So evidently Noah's ministry was 120 years, and it might have taken that long for him to build such a structure as the ark with the technology that he had. The ark was a huge structure, if you read the dimensions of it. And he had on the ark the various species, not every kind, not every breed of dog, not every breed of cat, you know, but the species. He had the basic species there. And then we have the Nephilim here, Nephilim. Let's go to Numbers 13:33. Numbers 13 and verse 33. The spies, when they came into the land of Canaan, they saw these giants and they were afraid. You know, the Canaanite people, some of them were of great stature. I'm sure a lot of them were fairly average, but, you know, these spies were very negative and kind of exaggerated. But there were people of great stature there who could have been very intimidating, no doubt. I don't doubt that. Anyway, verse 33, it says, "There we saw the giants, the Nephilim, the descendants of Anak, came from the giants. And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." So we saw these very big people, and it reminded us of the Nephilim that we, you know, that are there in the Noah account. So the term may have to do with being fallen. So I think the irony of it is that these were people who were very mighty, but they were fallen spiritually. They were great physically, but they were fallen spiritually. I think that's perhaps the irony of the term Nephilim. These giants, they were giants in the physical sense that you wouldn't want to meet one in a dark alley. But as far as spiritually speaking, no, they were corrupt, fallen. And evidently some of them were a progeny of these marriages that we read about, it would seem. There were giants on the earth in those days, verse 4, and also afterward when the sons of God came to the daughters of men and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. And their stories perhaps became some of the material that became the myths of the post-flood world that we hear about. Then the Eternal saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Eternal was sorry they had made man on the earth, so he grieved in his heart. So here we see God spoken of in anthropomorphic terms. Just the horror of what he was seeing was so great. Excuse me. So great that he decided to wipe out the creation and start anew with Noah and his family. So the Eternal said, "I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them." But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Eternal. Noah found favor, chen in Hebrew, the basis of the name Chana, the woman whose prayer brought about the coming of Samuel. But anyway, Noah found grace or favor in the eyes of the Eternal. And the rabbis quibble about Noah. I'll talk about that in just a moment. This is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man. You know, he was a tzaddik, a righteous man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. He was tam, right? He was blameless in his generations. There's a plural form of that that's used for Abraham in Genesis 17:1. You don't have to turn there, but when Abram was, I read about this recently. When Abram was 99 years old, the Eternal turned to Abram and said to him, I am Almighty God, or I am El Shaddai. Hetalech lefanai v'heye tamim. Walk before me and be blameless. Tamim. Blameless. And here we have the singular form, tam. He was perfect in his generations. By the way, Jacob is described in that same way, later as a person who was tam. You know, a person who was not a troublemaker, you know, not that kind of person. So he was perfect in his generations because he lived, of course, a long, long time. 12 jubilees before the flood, 7 jubilees after, 950 years. So he was in generations. He was in the generation prior to the flood and in the generation after. And many people probably came and went during his time. But he was perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. And the Hebrew would imply that he put out effort to do so. And so he was a righteous man, and he walked with God, and Noah begot 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. This doesn't necessarily mean that's all the children he had, but these are the ones that God spared with their wives to rebuild humanity. So there's not much more I can say at this time, but just to remember that the lesson that God did intervene, he did bring history to a climax, but yet he did spare his people and did repopulate the earth, because indeed he has a plan of salvation which is not going to be thwarted. And so there are new beginnings periodically in the history of God's plan, new beginnings. And this was one, a very important one, that at this time of the year we might want to think, we should, not might, but we should think about at this time of the year. I want to go to Genesis 8. As you know, he makes a covenant where when you see the rainbow, that becomes the symbol. I don't believe that there weren't rainbows before, but I would say that's a natural phenomenon, but he attached it to his promise so that when we see the rainbow, we would remember, the promise. Verse 21, after a sacrifice, animal sacrifice by Noah, verse 21, which of course points to the sacrifice of Christ. Verse 21, and the Eternal smelled a soothing aroma. Then the Eternal said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. So he makes some decisions here in mercy. And so over thousands of years, human beings have not had the kind of situation that occurred then. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, I'm in verse 22 of Genesis 8, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. So God says, no, I'm not going to flood out the world again. You're going to have basically the seasons and normal life and normal natural processes until such time as, you know, the climax. And then we do have prophecies about a very brief period at the end, which is, again, a climactic end, which will bring about, finally, you know, the millennium. I'd like to go to Genesis, to Isaiah 45 and verse 18. God has a plan. God all along foresaw what would be happening and provided for it. And in Isaiah 45 and verse 18, he says, he did not create the earth tohu. He did not create the earth in vain. Isaiah 45:18. For thus says the Eternal, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who has established it, who did not create it tohu in vain, who formed it to be inhabited. I am the Eternal and there is no other. God is unique in the universe. His plan will be fulfilled. His plan of salvation for humanity will be fulfilled. Now, if you go back to Genesis 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, but then, because of the sin of spirit beings, we do have tohu, but that's not how it started, necessarily. I mean, this is how I'm understanding Genesis 1. You don't have to understand it this way. I believe the earth became without form and void, tohu and bohu, in Genesis 1:2, Va'aretz hayita tohu va'vohu. The Rotherheim translation translates, the earth had become without form and void at that point, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God, excuse me, was hovering over the face of the waters. So God flooded out that creation. And so the world before Adam, the world of the mastodons and mammoths and these huge sloths, right? What the kind of huge critters, you know, animals, that was all flooded out. And we don't have Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal and these sorts of hominids. You know, that world was flooded out. And now we had a new world created in 6 days. And finally, human beings created on the sixth day. When was Adam created? A little before Eve. Anyway, but on the sixth day of creation, we have the creation of human beings. We have Adam and Eve, humankind as we understand it. So we had a new beginning. We had a flood, and we had a new beginning. But unfortunately, sin entered very quickly, and 1656 years we have sin. Then we have the great flood. Excuse me, eight people survive, and the human race then goes on from there, another new beginning. Finally, we have a great new beginning with the coming of Jesus Christ, and even a greater one. I shouldn't say that, but at least from our point of view, from the point of view of the effect on people, an even greater one when he returns and actually institutes his kingdom. And then even beyond that, a new beginning where we have the new heavens and the new earth. And that's where I'm going to in 2 Peter. 2 Peter refers to Genesis and the fact the earth emerged from the abyss, and it refers to the flood of Noah. And in 2 Peter 3, he refers also to the new heavens and new earth, and that's where I'm going, and that's where ultimately history is going, and that's what I'm going to read about in conclusion. In 2 Peter in verse 3, you know, people don't want to believe the account of Noah anymore, as I said. They want to think, well, we'll concede there might have been a local flood, but God isn't going to intervene in some dramatic way. We're going to have, you know, we're going to go out into space, and we're going to have, you know, I guess Star Wars and intergalactic wars, and, you know, we'll just go on and on with our sinning. We'll carry sin throughout the universe. That's how people think, maybe. But in verse 5 of 2 Peter 3, for this they willingly forget that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water in the water, as I showed you. You know, the darkness covered the face of the abyss, and then we come up with the world, or God came up with the world as we understand it, the world of Adam and Eve. But then that world was flooded out. Noah survived. By which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. Verse 7. But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire. Okay, so the flood has occurred, but now not a flood. No, this time fire. Fire. But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. What's going to happen to wickedness? It will burn up. What's going to happen to incorrigible people? They're going to be executed. They're going to be burned up as so much refuse. They will be ashes, as we understand. The Jews have a wonderful custom before the days of unleavened bread of burning the last crumbs of leaven. And that's symbolic of the burning of sinners, and the ultimate, you know, burning of the world as we know it in a recreated new heavens and new earth. In verse 8, but beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. So God is patient. He's not doing things on our timetable. He's doing things on his timetable. The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. So it's not that he wants people to perish. No. The flood of Noah was actually in order to save human beings, ultimately. And the coming of Jesus Christ and the plagues that will precede that time is an ultimately order to save human beings. And when the earth burns up, it's not to end the earth, but to renew it. There'll be a new heavens and a new earth. Verse 10. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? Knowing all this, we need to be staying on the straight and narrow. looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, Peter says, this is 2 Peter 3:13, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Therefore, beloved, looking forward to these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, without spot and blameless. That only comes if we have a right relationship with God through Jesus Christ, having received his Holy Spirit. So thinking about Noah, he was part of a special new beginning for God's plan of salvation. And the greatest new beginnings are, of course, going to be, have been, with the first coming of Jesus Christ, with his second coming, and then on into the time of the new heavens and new earth. We can look forward to that at this season of the year. Well, as I said, if this has stimulated you to read further into the account of Noah, then you can perhaps do that as something to do over the next number of days. And if you want to discuss some of that up at Concord, we'd be happy to do it, or through emails or phone calls, however you choose to do it. We do hope that you're handling the pressures of this season of the year, where there's a lot of preparation to do, and you're thinking about cleaning your home and maybe having company over and where you're going to go to services and on, you know, plus your daily work that we all have to do. Let's keep a balance in that and maintain our composure through all this, and just be very positive about it, because this is really a preparation for a very wonderful season, a time that pictures our eternal joy that is coming because of God's wonderful plan of salvation. So in the meantime, all the best to you and yours.